Case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the fifth case of the day, Quintana versus Chandler. Mr. Hessler.
May it please the court. My name is Daniel Hessler. I represent Carmelo Quintana. The state court's determinations that implicitly there was no ineffective assistance of counsel and explicitly that there was no prejudice were unreasonable.
Could I ask you a threshold question, please?
Of course.
About the evidentiary hearing. Did Mr. Quintana waive any right to such a hearing at the time that his counsel in the state court post-conviction proceeding rested on the affidavits alone? Because the state seems to think that he did waive the right to any evidentiary hearing on ineffective.
I think the answer is no, it wasn't waived. I'm paraphrasing because I'm going back by recollection, is that the counsel in the state court said, Judge, we would welcome the opportunity to prove up the affidavits. Essentially, they were saying, what's in the affidavits is what there is, but if you want to have an evidentiary hearing and demonstrate it, we can do that. I think essentially the state court declined to have one. I don't think it's true that counsel waived one. Because the federal court, federal district court, has already made a finding of ineffective assistance, and the state is not challenging that conclusion, I'm going to try to focus on the question of prejudice. The underlying question, and there's a couple layers here, is whether there was a reasonable probability that Mr. Quintana would have accepted the four-year plea offer at 50% had he been informed that he was facing mandatory consecutive sentences of 6 years on two different counts at 85% instead of 50% good time. And the question under Section 2254D is whether the state court was unreasonable in deciding that there was no prejudice on that. And the overwhelming evidence of prejudice in this case is, apart from the fact that Mr. Quintana says that had he known, he would have pled, is that under the facts of this case, absolutely anyone would have pled if they'd been informed of what they were facing. That's the corroboration here.
But hasn't Mr. Quintana's pattern of lying reduced his own credibility to zilch?
Close to it. He lied in his state court trial. There's absolutely no question about that. Whether he lied in the evidentiary hearing or not is debatable. I could spend my entire 10 minutes debating it, but I would rather not. The question is, I think I raised a hypothetical in my brief and said that if we had four people hanging from the edge of a 27-story building, this one, Rod Blagojevich, a priest, a rabbi, and a Boy Scout, and all said four said they were scared, would we believe all of them? And I think the answer is yes. There are some statements that it's the statement that is believable, not the declarant. And whether it is the priest or Rod Blagojevich or Carmelo Quintana, when Mr. Quintana says, yes, I would have taken that had I been informed, it's a believable statement. The operative facts here are the likelihood of conviction and the consequences of that conviction. The consequences are alarming. On a plea, he was looking at exactly 4 years, the 50% good time. He could have done 2 years. After trial, he was looking at least 10.2. I went through the math in my brief. I won't go through it again. That's a bigger differential in penalty than anything that we've seen in the case law on these cases.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary deal offered by the state in this case, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, speaking to your disparity, Mr. Hessler, I rarely see a case where in the factual background of this case, the state offered for whatever reason, and we can always speculate. So I just want to kind of shrink that range.
I think it was probably a reasonable deal because He was not the primary rapist. It's bad no matter what. This is an ugly case.
Yes.
But he's the 18-year-old kid along with the guy who tries to rape the woman. The 18-year-old kid is guilty, but not as culpable as Navarette. I don't mean to disparage the seriousness of the crime in any way, shape, or form. And that's why that two-year offer made sense.
We need something more than a large disparity, though. Otherwise, any case where there's a large disparity between the plea offer and the ultimate exposure and the sentence imposed after trial when a plea offer is declined would be enough to establish prejudice, and I don't think our cases stand for that proposition.
We have a combination.
Nor is that a good application of Sixth Amendment law.
Sort of a perfect storm of a huge disparity, both counsel and the defendant saying, yes, he wasn't told about this disparity. He wasn't told about the consequences. And it's a basic factor of being a defense lawyer that you tell your client what he's looking at. And if it's knowable, you tell him. And if you don't know, you tell him you don't know. But this, it's unquestioned that that's what happened here. And the likelihood of conviction. Maybe it would have been worth going to trial if there would have been a shot. This was a case with a clear confession. The government the state has made a lot about the fact that he was claiming innocence. Well, he wasn't claiming innocence on the day that he was arrested. He made a detailed confession, and the part that made it so devastating is partly that it matched what the victim said, and partly that it didn't. Because if the cops had been making it up, it would have matched the victim in all respects.
But he was claiming innocence for the purposes and the facts relevant here, which is to say to his attorney, this is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and he continued to insist throughout to his attorney that he wasn't responsible for this, he didn't do anything wrong, and that the person who did it was long gone to Mexico, and that's the important point here, is that his attorney at least said in his affidavit, and that's what was before the state post-conviction court, that he insisted he was innocent, and so didn't talk at length about the deal.
The attorney nevertheless has an obligation, and I think I said it in an ABA rule, to tell him, okay, nevertheless, this is what you're looking at in terms of sentencing, and this is your likelihood of conviction. And if he never mentioned to him, by the way, you made this statement, this confession, and this is coming in at trial, you put those things together, and this is a case where, objectively, as the state trial court pointed out, there was the case was overwhelming. There was no chance of beating this at trial. I see that my light is on, and I want to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Ms. O'Connell.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Erin O'Connell on behalf of the respondent warden. I'd like to emphasize here that the petitioner already received an extraordinary remedy in a habeas case. The district court looked at the affidavits, looked at the sentencing disparity, and saw enough of a Sixth Amendment issue to call for an evidentiary hearing, which, as this court knows, it is extremely rare. The petitioner was allowed to try to convince the district court that he would have taken this deal, and he responded to that opportunity by getting on the stand and lying on numerous occasions, to the point that the district court was constrained to find that he lacked sufficient credibility to establish that he would have accepted the state's plea offer. The petitioner at this point, knowing that he lacks credibility, seems to be asking for a test that ignores his own personal characteristics and just says, would a hypothetical reasonable person in these circumstances have taken the deal? But that's not the test that the Supreme Court set forth in Lafler or the test that this court has applied in ruling in similar cases. The test speaks of the particular defendant. What was his mindset at the time that this plea deal was offered to him? Now, in most cases where there has been a finding of prejudice, the key piece of evidence, and that's missing here, is a course of plea negotiations that demonstrate in some way that the defendant was in fact willing to accept responsibility and plead guilty. That happened in Lafler. The defendant actually told the trial judge that he was guilty and was interested in pleading guilty. That distinguishes this from Julian versus Bartley. In that case, the petitioner had tentatively accepted a plea deal, and he only changed course based on erroneous advice that he received from counsel. Here, we have absolutely no evidence that this petitioner was ever willing to accept responsibility. And in fact, all the evidence shows that the reason he rejected the plea deal was because he insisted to counsel that he was innocent of the crime and apparently believed, even though, as counsel concedes, he had a weak defense, that doesn't mean that his client didn't believe at the time of trial that he was going to prevail on that defense. And just to briefly address whether he waived the right to a hearing, I think Your Honor is referring to a remark in the district court's opinion that the petitioner had seemed not to request an evidentiary hearing in the state court. I think that's a bit too strict of a reading of what counsel was saying at that hearing. Counsel did say that she wanted an evidentiary hearing to authenticate the affidavit, which in the strictest sense means we just want to verify that this is an authentic affidavit, but I think more broadly she was saying bring this person in to receive live testimony. Our argument that petitioner was not entitled to an evidentiary hearing is just based on 2254D and Cullen versus Pinholster and the fact that here on the record that was before the state court, the petitioner failed to show that the state court was unreasonable in finding a lack of prejudice and therefore holding the evidentiary hearing was erroneous in that sense.
Before the judge ordered the evidentiary hearing, did the state argue to him that Mr. Quintana had waived the right to such a hearing?
No, Your Honor. And so we would have also forfeited an argument of that sort. But I think a fair reading of the state court record is that his counsel was asking for an evidentiary hearing in any event. So if the court has no further questions, we would ask that the court affirm the denial of habeas corpus relief.
Thank you, Ms. Mr. Hessler.
The state points out a lack of evidence in the state court, unlike some cases like Loeffler and Julian. The reason for that is because of the nature of what happened here. This was a lack of advice case as opposed to an affirmative misadvice case. This was a case where the counsel was only meeting with the defendant at court, never hiring translators, using the co-defendant and the co-defendant's lawyer as interpreters, and having all of his meetings in the presence of the co-defendant. For this reason, Mr. Quintana was not, because of all this horrendous defense lawyering, that's the reason why there was never, Mr. Quintana didn't have reason to raise a record when the trial was going on because he didn't know what he was missing. The state says there's absolutely no evidence that he was willing to plead guilty. His confession on the day of his arrest is the evidence that he might have considered something. The state courts were unreasonable to determine that a failure to tell somebody what they were facing or the likelihood that they were facing was effective assistance of counsel. This is that rare case. It doesn't happen very often. The state is correct. There's not very many evidentiary hearings granted in federal court. The reason is because this was the exceptional case.
What do we do with the findings of the district judge, Mr. Hessler? How do we review those?
They're reviewed de novo.
Yeah.
I think you can...
We have to find clear error, don't we, with a district judge's finding on the on the credibility issue?
The credibility issue, no, it's a de novo review. The
district court said he's incredible, his testimony, as to whether he would have accepted. I mean, that's what the hearing in large measure.
We're not even sure if the hearing I am trying to dodge the issue of whether the hearing should happen. Cullen versus Penholster said it shouldn't have. And I said at the time, Judge, I'm not sure this should happen, but it happened. The question is, did the state court err on these affidavits? Is somebody believable? No matter what you say about Carmelo Quintana, he's not a bright guy. He's an uneducated guy. But when he says, had I known this was possible, I would have chosen differently. And given what he didn't know, that's a believable statement. And that's the prejudice. And this is also, it's not really a finding of fact. It's what would have happened. And all we have to show, all this court has to find, is a reasonable probability. You don't have to be certain. But if there's a reasonable probability that things would have been different had he known, then this court should reverse the judgment of the district court, and habeas relief should be granted. He's done 14 years. It's long enough.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. The case is taken under